gentlemen, welcome back to the preseason podcast of the year. I'm in a good mood, y'all, and you could tell right out the gate. I got a big Kool-Aid smile on my face right now, the same Kool-Aid smile that my godmother always teases me about, and I'm just feeling in high spirits right now, and I'm going to tell you why, because this is one of the most special podcasts we've ever recorded. Today is Saturday, May 30th, 2015. I'm your host, Jay Hicks. This is the Hip Hop Sports Report Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I'm floating on air right now, y'all, because we have a very, very special podcast. For one reason I'm floating on air is because my Cleveland Cavaliers are in the NBA Finals, back in the NBA Finals where they belong, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But our guest this evening is joining us for, I don't even know how many times, maybe the fifth or sixth time, but on this particular edition of the podcast, we're going to get into his new book entitled Natural Life. And I want to read you guys something really quickly here about our guest today. And before I get into that, remember, you can hit us on Twitter at twitter.com/HHSReport, facebook.com/HHSReport. We're on Google Plus as well. This podcast can be heard in your ear holes if you download and subscribe on iTunes. And we're also on Stitcher as well. So please check us out. And again, before we get into the year ad here hotline, I did want to bring up one other just little minor detail, one little minor nugget of information that you guys should be aware of. By the time you hear this podcast, you will have probably gone out to hiphopsportsreport.com like the faithful listener you are and the faithful reader that you are and seen our brand new website, y'all. We got a new website. Yes. New hiphopsportsreport.com. We're launching it on Monday, June the 1st. That's when you'll probably be hearing this podcast. And y'all, I just cannot convey to you how much it means to me to update this site, give the site the facelift it deserves, and it looks fantastic. I want to shout out my girl Sasha. Thank you for hooking us up with that. And there's a little link at the bottom where you can check out her other work there with Infamous Labs. You can check that out because she's got mad skills with the computer thing. You know what I'm saying? Now, I don't have those type of skills, so I had to outsource it. You know what I mean? And the website that we had was serviceable for a long time, and we love the old website, but this new format is dope, and it's really unique and looks fresh, and I just really want you guys to enjoy it. If you like what you see, please, 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 please share it. Tell somebody about it. Call them up, call your mother, call your father, call your daughter, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter, call whoever. It just let somebody know, text somebody, whatever, that, hey man, hiphopsportsreport.com. You remember hiphopsportsreport.com, that website that gets all the predictions correct about everything? Yeah, they got a new look. So go ahead and check us out there because it's crazy. And I've been wanting to do this for a long time, and I finally had the time and energy and everything else required to put into revamping that site for you. I didn't do it for me. I did it for y'all, and it looks pleasing to the eye. It's aesthetically pleasing, and I'm very, very proud of it. So please, y'all, check it out. Share it with somebody. We got a lot of new content coming out on Monday for the relaunch of the website, so please check that out. And shout out my man Anthony Houston, who is a frequent contributor to the site. He's doing this thing as well, as is our guest this evening. So let me go ahead and read this quick excerpt right here, and we'll get started on the Your Ad Here hotline with our guest. Now, let me read this right now. Kenneth Hicks does not believe in luck. Through talent, hard work, and experience, he has been honing his craft since 1998. The Cleveland, Ohio native released his first book, I Know This To Be True, in 2004. After founding Obelisk Media Group with co-founder, author Jabril B. Turner Sr., shout out to the B team, Hicks went on to release Intercourse, The Chronicles of a Cyber, Casanova, and Learning the Way, the erudition of Charisse Bell, co-written by Turner, both in 2011. Kenneth currently resides outside of Los Angeles, California, where he continues to write novels as well as screenplays. Aside from writing, Kenneth enjoys music, fashion, sports, especially his Browns, Cavs, and Ohio State football, and being a father to his beautiful daughter, Nyla Hicks. Natural Life is his fourth book. Natural Life is the reason why he's here this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, author extraordinaire, Mr. Kenneth Hicks.
Man, that is the most amazing introduction I've ever gotten in life for anything. And so, yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. I feel great, man. I feel humbled to even have that kind of introduction. You know, I'm here to kind of talk about this book today, and I'm really excited to be here and excited to talk about it because it's been a long time coming, and I know that you personally know, you know, just that this has been a project that's been a passion project of mine for a long time. So to actually see it through to fruition and to have it be able to come out and have it in people's hands, it means a lot to me. So I'm just thankful to be here.
No doubt, man. And that introduction should be great because I got it right out of the back of your book. So that's straight from the horse's mouth, you know what I'm saying? But it's all true. Everything in there is true. I've known you all my life because you are my older brother, as many of you have probably pieced together by this point. And I'm very proud of you for seeing this through, as you pointed out. I've been proud of all your books, and they're all very good, and I've read them all. And you can get all of them on opalistmediagroup.com. Please check that out. Also, the new book is also available on Amazon and is available for sale on the Kindle, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so we'll have links to all that stuff when we go ahead and post this podcast to the website, hiphopsportsupport.com. Now, you mentioned that this has been a passion project for a long time. Natural Life, give us a brief synopsis, because we obviously don't want to give anything away. And tell us how you kind of came about wanting to write a story like this, because it's unlike anything you've written before.
Well, you're right. It is unlike anything that I've written to date. Natural Life in and of itself, it came, it was kind of like a perfect storm kind of thing. It was inspired by a couple different things. But in addition to the inspirations, it was just a matter of them all kind of weaving together in a way that kind of interlocked and told a story that I felt was kind of important and necessary to be told at this point in time. For me, a good large inspiration for this project initially came from actually the rap album Illmatic by one of my favorite MCs of all time, Nas. Illmatic is my favorite album of all time. Reason being was that I thought that it did a great job of depicting what the lifestyle and the mindset of a young man growing up in Queensbridge was at that time. And I've seen that same, story play out a few other times in hip hop. I think T.I. did that with trap music. I think that, Kendrick Lamar in particular did that with Good Kid, Mad City. And, I just wanted to do something like that for my city. You know, I wanted to tell a Cleveland story because Cleveland stories don't get told all the time. And, you know, a lot of times, unless you're in a major city, you get overlooked. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people that are going through everyday struggles and having everyday problems. And, you know, they don't necessarily have the backdrop of New York and Miami or Los Angeles. So I just want to give something that people from my city can relate to.
Word up. Now, you mentioned that Illmatic was your favorite album, your favorite rap album of all time. And I remember for a long time it was like Volume 1 by Jay-Z. It was in my lifetime Volume 1. What changed? What made you switch over to Illmatic as your personal favorite?
Well, you know, it's one of those situations where it's probably like a 1 and 1A kind of thing. I love both albums completely. I really do. I think that for me, I thought that although I do love In My Lifetime Volume 1 by Jay-Z, I do think that at the same time, it's a situation where that's not something that you can just relate to on an everyday level. You know, I think there's a lot more people that can relate to where Nas was coming from on Illmatic than on, this Jay-Z album, which was a great album, but again, it's just talking about this, you know, kingpin mafioso kind of persona, and that's not something that everybody can relate to, but a lot more people I think can just relate to just growing up in a circumstance where you don't necessarily know that everything is going to be safe and everything's going to be okay. And everything's not just a given. And sometimes you have to, you know, you have to fight for your way in this world. And I think that that was just something that I wanted to depict.
It's funny that you say that because when I think about Volume 1, the first thing that comes to my mind is like Imaginary Player, and that was like one of my favorite songs off that record. And when you mentioned, you know, what do people relate to, I think I relate more to the fictitious guy that Jay-Z was talking about at the end of Imaginary Player. Like, yo, dog, what's the difference between a 4.0 and a 4.6? That's the guy that I relate to. I don't relate to Jay-Z to my boss. You know what I'm saying? The drug kingpin, Big Willie. I don't relate to him. I relate to the guy like, that car looks nice. I wonder what kind of car that is. What's the difference between a 4.0 and a 4.6? And if you don't know how Jay responded, you can go ahead and listen to that. But at any rate, and you mentioned earlier that this book was like an album in some ways, is a Cleveland story, and Cleveland stories don't always get told. What about this book, besides just the setting, you know what I mean? Because that's pretty straightforward. But what about it makes it a Cleveland story, and how does it encapsulate a Cleveland story back in that time when it takes place, which I guess is basically from like roughly mid-1990s through maybe mid-2000s. How is it uniquely a Cleveland story?
Well, you know, Cleveland has a blue-collar mentality, you know, and the thing is that when you're telling a Cleveland story, it has to be true to what Cleveland is. And don't get me wrong, Cleveland has always had, you know, people that were successful and people making money, and you know, whether it was legally or illegally. But at the same time, no, we're not New York City. We're not Philadelphia. We're not Los Angeles. You know, so being, you know, there's a different, you know, I guess, structure, I guess, as far as being the kingpin or being king of the city, so to speak. And this story isn't about being king of the city or anything like that, per se, but it's just that there's a different mentality. Like I said, it's a blue-collar mentality. It's a blue-collar town. Things are just not... you know, things are definitely, you know, showing flashy in their own ways, but it just may not be what people are accustomed to if you look at a video shot in Miami or something like that. But beyond that, though, like I said, you know, you have a town where people are economically depressed. You know, in the time frame of the book, and even up to this day, you know, present time, you know, it's an economically depressed city. It's a Rust Belt town. And, you know, you have... the lack of education, the lack of opportunity, the lack of jobs, then it creates a vacuum. And in that vacuum, you have a lot of hostility. You have cold weather. You know, these are all factors. These are all things, you know, if you ever sat there and you froze here, you're behind us, you know, on a Cleveland afternoon waiting for your school bus, you know, it's definitely going to put a frown on your face, you know, and some of those frowns kind of stick around 24/7. You know, it's just part of the city, you know, we don't really play a lot of games. You know, we're not really for the flashy stuff, all like that. But at the same time, though, we're just a different kind of mindset, you know. And I think that because of the story being what it is, it kind of is unique to the Midwest. And I think that maybe people from other Midwest towns may be able to directly identify with it. But a lot of the overall arching themes are something that you could be from anywhere and you could still relate to it on a certain level.
Definitely. And... the interesting part about Cleveland, for some that don't know, is, you know, like John D. Rockefeller, he based his headquarters in Cleveland, Ohio. Like, Cleveland, Ohio was not always this downtrodden, economically depressed community. It was actually quite the contrary back in the day.
Absolutely.
Things changed, obviously, and they shut down a lot of factory jobs. They outsourced a lot of those jobs. And the job started drying up, and that's basically what it boils down to. When the job starts to dry up, then the economy starts to dry up. People start moving away. People start looking for an escape out. It's funny because that even people in our generation, and we're not that old, but people in our generation, they really feel like it's an accomplishment to make it out of Cleveland. Even people that grew up in the suburbs feel like it's an accomplishment to make it out of Cleveland and make it someplace else. Now, I've always maintained that, you know, they say if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And you and I agree that, you know, okay, that's all well and good, and that's true. But people go to New York to make it all the time. Nobody makes it in Cleveland, or at least very few either make it or try to make it even in Cleveland. We even saw that with LeBron. LeBron said, man, this is tough. I got to get out of here, you know? And then he bounces. Exactly. And then he, quote unquote, makes it, right? And now he's coming back trying to switch up that narrative. But that's just the kind of community that Cleveland is. We've always, at least within the last 50 years or so, pretty much as long as our sports teams have been trash, we've pretty much been kind of on this downward spiral. And it's just now starting to turn, I feel like, not just with the basketball team, but just with some of the innovations downtown that they're putting in. They put in the new medical center down there. They put in obviously the casino downtown. So there's this urban renewal that's taking effect in Cleveland, and it's not overnight, but it's something that's happening. Now, obviously, Cleveland was in the news with the police officers that I forget his name. His name escapes me already. But the police officer that shot those two victims, those African-American victims, through the windshield 15 times and somehow got off. You know, that happens in Cleveland. I guess Cleveland is not so different from a lot of other cities as far as that's concerned. But just that whole element of having cops and the quote-unquote bad guys, and typically you look at the bad guys as those people, the criminals, the people that are doing wrong by the community, and then you have the police, the judicial system, which are typically classified as the good guys, but I think as we're starting to see, that might not always be the case. Natural Life depicts the system and the prison lifestyle in a way that was so incredibly vivid. I mean, it was nothing like I've ever read before, and that's not an exaggeration. Kenny, where did you get, and I call you Kenny because you're my brother, I guess your professional name is Kenneth, where did you get some of the inspiration behind the scenes in prison in that book? And I think we may have gotten away from it. I probably pulled you off subject. Give the listeners a little bit of a synopsis about what the book is about exactly.
Okay, I do apologize for that, because that was the initial question here. But the book itself is a story about a young man named Elijah Hughes. Elijah Hughes is growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, and he's growing up in the inner city. With that being said, there's certain trials and tribulations that he encounters on a day-to-day basis. Because of the fact that he has encountered these things, whether it's just violence in his community, whether it's the use and abuse of drugs in his community, whether it's the poor educational system, all the things that go with it, he's experienced this on a day-to-day basis. And while people from other walks of life may not be particularly familiar with that, and they may look at some of the things that he encounters on a day-to-day basis and think, oh my gosh, this is crazy. How are people living like this? But for him, this is natural life. This is just the way that things are. And that being said, he winds up getting caught up with some of his friends into some illegal activities, and he winds up on the criminal side of a double homicide. He subsequently gets sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, which is also known as natural life. So it's kind of a play on words. And, you know, it's just basically about his struggle to redeem himself, his struggle for his safety in prison, his struggle to make a better way for himself in this world, his struggle to get free, his struggle to have peace of mind and separate himself from the cycle of prison and crime that a lot of people get caught up into. And he's just really looking for an opportunity to just say enough is enough, and I just want to have that peace of mind. One of my favorite hip-hop lines of all time, it's not even a real line per se, as much of a lyric to the song, but in Mos Def, Umi says, he says, sometimes I'm tired of being a soldier, sometimes I just want to be a man. And that's really what the book is about, is as he grows up, he doesn't want to be a soldier in the war in the streets anymore. He just wants to be a man, and that's what he's looking to do.
What's amazing about the Elijah Hughes story, and it's amazing because it's so different from the everyday lives of most Americans, but not necessarily the everyday lives of a lot of African Americans in the inner city, is that he cannot seem to escape this negative lifestyle around him. He's constantly in search of that outlet. He's working with different people. He befriends certain people that are important to him, that have a different outlook on life than what he was normally accustomed to hearing, but he kept being sucked back in. Now, granted, you're not necessarily trying to solve all of the community's ills with this book, but how does somebody try to escape that lifestyle? I mean, because as you'll see in the book, Elijah, I mean, he falters and he backslides and he does stuff that he doesn't necessarily intend to do. And even when his his heart is in the right place, his head is not always in the right place. What do you think that is a function of, which is a very loaded question, I understand, but what is that a function of, and how do we rise up out of that?
Well, I mean, I think that that's, to your point, it is kind of a loaded question, but more so than that, though, I think that ultimately what I've learned just throughout my general observations in life is just that whenever you have a large systematic problem or a large sweeping problem, there never is just one cause of it or one solution to it. It's just a multitude of little things that have kind of come together to create that environment where this type of phenomenon exists. So whether it's racism or whether it's, like I said, the prison industrial complex or whatever it is, it's a lot of things that have created that. And there's a lot of things that you would need to do and have in place in order to separate yourself from that. And this is kind of hopefully going to answer your last question and this one together. But my research for the book, one of the things that I've done is, I did a lot of research and watching, documentaries and shows about prison lifestyle and things like that. But I've also had a lot of, discussions with people who are close to me who have actually been in and are currently incarcerated. And in doing so, when you look at, the situation, a lot of them are kind of facing the same kind of situation that Elijah faces. And it's like you come out and you're being released into the same situation in the same neighborhood that you got into the problems with to begin with. And if you don't have the economic ability to, or even sometimes even legally, if you're not even able to move from that area, it's hard to overcome those same temptations or even deal with those same issues. If you had somebody who had a problem with you and you went away for some time and you come home and that person's still looking for you, you have to defend yourself and you want to protect yourself. And these become very real problems for people who are stuck in that cycle. I think that overall, I would hope that, anybody who is genuine about, rehabilitating themselves and making a better way for themselves in life, I would, do whatever is necessary to build a support system around you. And that could be anybody. That could just be friends. It could be family members. It could be people from a local church or other religious organization if you have some kind of affiliation like that. It could be, good friends of yours who were doing positive things beforehand. Just anybody who can be a positive impact on you, because anything that you're doing that's positive is taking away from the opportunity that you have to do something negative. So even if you're just over a friend's house watching their daughter and you guys are watching TV together or something, that doing that on a Friday night might be better than going out to the same streets that you were in before where you had all the problems, And it's just about, like I said, having those networks of people around that can be supportive of you, that can, help you. Because a lot of times the system is in place in a way that is rigged to actually get you caught back up in it, But if you actually have strong people around you and you have people who aren't doing the things that can get you caught back up on probation violations and things like that, then I think that's what can maximize your opportunity and give you the best chance at success.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the book itself again, and that was well said. But obviously, we could go on all day about that. I want to touch on a couple of the characters real quick. Three of them in particular that were kind of Elijah's road dogs coming up: Maceo, Boogie, and Noodles. Obviously, without trying to give away too much, what can you tell us about those three individuals?
Maceo, Boogie, and Noodles were guys from his neighborhood. Boogie and Noodles were in his class. They kind of grew up together. They were boys. Maceo was a little bit older than them. Maceo was one of the people that kind of introduced them to some of the negative things that they were doing in life. He was the guy that had guns available, that they first, got their hands on and, first got to see what it was like to steal and shoot a gun. He was a drug dealer, so they knew him. And when they were looking to kind of get in the game, it kind of fell into their lap because of the fact that it was something that they just kind of grew into because of the environment they were in. And, a lot of times, these older people, they scout these kids just like, the NBA or anything else. They keep their eye on them. They know who's smart. They know who's not smart. They know who they can trust. They know who's not trustworthy, and they groom them, and then they bring them along, and they coerce them, and they give them incentive to want to be a part of something greater than what they already are. And a lot of times, that's how these kids just get sucked into that lifestyle, you know. And you know, that was kind of what Maceo was doing. Boogie was Maceo's brother, or he is Maceo's brother in the book. And he is just not so much in it as much as Maceo is, but he's just kind of going along with the flow. Again, he's just another kid that, you know, this is what his older brother's doing. His brother's kind of the man around town, to a certain degree, at least amongst, like, you know, the kids. You know, he's a young dope boy. So, that being said, he kind of gets a certain level of respect, and all these other kids have been looking up to him. And, when he sees his friends kind of gravitating towards that, you know, Boogie does the same, just as, you know, because of that. And Noodles is another one of his friends who does the same thing as well. Noodles happens to take to it a little more so than, some of the other ones. He actually, you know, he has a degraded career in crime, that kind of grows out of this early introduction into the drug culture of Cleveland.
I think you said in the book that Noodles got his name because he used to eat chicken noodle soup as a kid, and he asked his mom, what part of the chicken is the noodle? Is that right?
Yes.
That's one of my favorite lines of the book. I thought that was hilarious.
You know, it's just something innocent that kids do. You know, I got a 3-year-old, so it's something that, you know, she might be asking me in a year or two. I wouldn't be surprised. Not so much about chicken noodle soup per se, but, you know, something along those lines.
That's a fair question. You know, I mean, you might want to know what part of the noodle is. You got the wings, you got the leg, the breast, the thighs, the noodles. You know, I mean, naturally, I mean, that line of thinking, that linear thinking, it kind of makes sense to me. I mean, right? But what do I know?
Where is the chicken noodle?
Now, what I really liked about Natural Life 2, beyond the fact of the vivid depiction of life in behind bars and street life for that matter, was the fact that it kind of talked about a lot of different elements of life. And I think a lot of times our American society as a whole, we kind of cast this negative viewpoint of the inner city and just kind of look at them like they're just these crazy people that just live like it's the Wild Wild West out here, just shooting up everything and everybody and selling dope and destroying our communities and all that type of stuff, when really it's just people just trying to live life like everybody else. Is there's the same stories, the same hopes, the same dreams, the same disappointments and letdowns and heartache and heartbreak and all that type of stuff. It's all the same because we're all just people. And I like how Elijah, in the beginning, he's working for a guy named Black, and he basically ends up getting convinced that, you know, he's doing a little too much work and not getting compensated properly, which is something I think that everybody can relate to. I thought that was really cool. Talk a little bit about that dynamic and just how maybe he got a little mixed up, maybe he got some bad information, and maybe what's the right way to handle a situation where you feel like, maybe my boss isn't doing right by me.
I think that in the story, you know, the thing was that for Elijah, he was basically experiencing what anybody experiences when they have, you know, a first job. You know, and although, this is natural life, so let's look at it in the context of what it is. This is basically a first job. You know, in other cities, you know, that first job might be, you know, working at McDonald's or something. You know, my first job, I worked at an electronics store. You know, that was my first job. But if I, you know, grew up in a different environment, things may be different, you know, and hopefully not for me per se, but I'm just saying that that's just how things work in this world. So that being said, when you have a job and you're doing this job and you're starting at the entry level and this is, you know, you're a young kid and you're like, man, I should be really having a lot of success at this. And maybe you are having success, but if you look around and you have this perceived notion that other people are maybe doing better than what you are doing, then you feel like maybe you're entitled to something. You know, a lot of kids feel like they're entitled to more than what they deserve. And I'm not saying that Elijah was or was not entitled to it, but I am just saying that he felt that way. And that's a very logical thing that a lot of kids feel, especially when they get that first job. Some kids are just happy just to have a job, but after a while, you know, that minimum wage doesn't look as good as it used to. And, you know, so he heard that he may be getting some kind of promotion of sorts, and then he sounded like he may get skipped over for it or something like that. And, you know, things like that happen, and just like any other job, if that were to happen, you may feel a certain kind of way. Honestly, you know, I think that across the board, regardless of what field you're in, you know, the best way to, I guess, move past that is just, again, this is Hip Hop Sports Report. I guess the best comparison I could give would be a sports one, you know. Let your speaking on the field do it for you, you know, and be the best that you can be at whatever it is that you're doing, and be productive at your job, and, you know, let that be what, you know, helps propel you forward in life, as opposed to belly aching and worrying about what other people are doing. You know, and when you look at something like this, you know, you think, you hear about a kid like this, and at the same time, there's part of you and you're thinking, wow, what a waste. This kid's out here selling drugs and you know, destroying neighborhoods and families and things like that. But at the same time, you're thinking, you know, if he could have just taken that same effort and that same know-how and that same ingenuity and put it towards some positive, who knows what he could have been doing now. He could have been a successful business owner. He could have, you know, been a college graduate. He could have been a lot of different things. But it's just that he was in an environment that fostered him looking at this in a negative way, as opposed to using his talents and skill for something positive.
I like what you said about the sports analogy, because I kind of liken it to the Dion Waiters situation. Because Dion Waiters, like, here's the thing, man. I always defended Dion Waiters like harder than anybody. And the reason why was not because he was the greatest player ever or anything like that. And he's a very good player, very talented. My defense was because I could empathize with his story. And it's like, if you put yourself in his shoes, this dude was the best player on his college team, but they made him come off the bench. He goes in the NBA. He goes way higher in the draft than anybody initially anticipates. He ends up being the fourth pick of the draft. Think about that. He was the fourth overall pick of the draft. For perspective's sake, Dwayne Wade and Charles Barkley were the fifth pick of the draft. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, if you're the fourth pick, like, yeah, you're in good company. You know, Chris Bosh was the fourth pick of the draft. Like, you can be a really good player and be a franchise caliber player picked in that spot. Absolutely. Like, you don't have to just be number one. So he was picked fourth overall in a draft that people thought was pretty good. And he ends up coming off the bench as a pro. And they basically say to him, you know what, you're talented, we like you, we believe in you, but you're still not deemed capable of starting for this team. Kyrie gets hurt. Deion comes in and plays well as the primary ball handler and primary offensive threat for the Cavs last year. And but people still looked at him in that way, like, oh, he's just a bench player. He's just got to accept his role as a bench player in this league. And it's like, if you're Deion Waiters, would you want to come off the bench? Because I don't think I want to come off the bench either. He averaged like 16 a game last year. So in my second year, I'm averaging 16 points a game. I was the fourth overall pick in the draft. I was the best player on my college team while coming off the bench. My time is now. No other fourth overall pick is asked to come off the bench. Why am I asked to come off the bench? And they make all these videos about him jumping up and down, asking for the ball and stuff. That's because he can score. You know what I'm saying? So I kind of feel like, yeah. Now, he ended up getting traded, and that wound up being the best thing for the Cavaliers team. But I don't think that the Deion Waiters story is going to just die in Oklahoma City and he's just destined to be some bench player. I think he can still be a very productive player in this league. And so that's kind of like, you know, Elijah's situation was not too dissimilar. He was getting passed over for not any real great reasons, you know what I'm saying? And just like you said, it's all about how you handled it. Maybe Deion didn't necessarily always handle it well. And which is understandable, frankly, but I don't think Elijah necessarily handled it well either at all times.
Right.
Now, there's also, you know, a love story in Natural Life, a couple of them really, and there's a, you know, he has this weird relationship with his mom, you know what I'm saying? I think that the women in this book were interesting because they're not the ones that are in the streets in this book, but yet they played a pivotal role. And there's three central female characters in this book. You don't have to necessarily break down each character, but just kind of tell me a little bit about the women in this book and why they're important.
Well, you know, the thing is that anybody who is, you know, spending time in or around the African-American community, they know that, you know, our community is built on strong women. And, you know, these women in the story, you know, they're all strong in their own right. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, when you talk about his mother is somebody who wanted the best for her son, but she didn't necessarily have the means to always give him the best of everything, you know. And sometimes she just had to do what was necessary in order to make ends meet and things like that. So she worked a lot of hours, and she was not always necessarily in the household to watch her son. And that was kind of part of his downfall. You know, when you have a household like his where he didn't have that second set of eyes, he didn't have a father in the household or even like an older brother, anybody like that, that would be able to watch him and take care of him and keep him out of trouble and keep him away from certain things. Because his mother was just doing everything that she could to keep the you know, the food on the table and the lights on. And, you know, and if she could, and it, because of the fact that she didn't always have the time to spend with him, you know, she would try to compensate it the best way that she could. So she would buy him a pair of Jordans or something like that, because she knew that that was just how she could show him love, because she couldn't always do all the things that she wanted to do. She maybe because she couldn't take him on vacations, or she couldn't necessarily, you know, put him in band, you know, drum lessons over the summer or something like that. But what she could do is she could buy him a pair of Jordans so he could feel good and look good while he's walking around. You know, as far as beyond that, you know, you start looking at his romantic life and things like that. You know, there was a woman that he or a young girl actually that he met when he was still a kid himself, and you know, her relationship with him plays a pivotal role in the story. You know, they have a very close relationship, and it's just one of those things where the part of the allure of the relationship for her is the fact that he is selling drugs and he is in the streets. But, you know, it becomes very real when he winds up getting locked up and there is no sign of when he's coming home. You know, how long can you actually stay committed and stay faithful and stay focused on somebody who you don't even know if they'll ever come home again? You know, and it's just, again, it's just a situation where we have, you know, this man, this young man or this young boy trying to become a man, and he wants to be as strong as he can, but he has these women in his life. And, you know, it's just that through their strength gives him strength at certain points. And, you know, it's in retaining those relationships and mending those relationships and strengthening them that's part of the motivating factor for him even, you know, turning his life around.
Now, there's Elijah encounters some interesting characters when he's on lockdown, but he encounters some old heads with some wisdom, and he encounters his boy Nate. Nate might have been my favorite character in the entire book. Talk about those guys and what they meant to the story a little bit, because they provide, I think, a different perspective than what people might normally think of when they think of Life Behind Bars.
Well, the thing about it is that, you know, life behind bars is like anything else in life. You know, human beings are creatures of habit, and, you know, there's protocol in place, you know, and it's really about following that protocol and learning how to maneuver in it in a way that's going to be beneficial to you and give you the least resistance and the least problems as possible. You know, and sometimes it's not always easy to do that in a situation like that, because of the fact that although you may not be looking for problems, there may be other people who are looking for problems with you. And, you know, sometimes you get pulled into those situations whether you want to be or not. But, you know, as far as the characters that he encounters, you know, he does encounter some, you know, some guys that, you know, some tough guys and some guys that want to get problems. But he also has, you know, he encounters people that are actually in his corner. You know, he, like you said, he finds an old head in there who actually is able to give him some insight and give him some wisdom. You know, that's something that he'd been missing his whole life. You know, as a young man who didn't grow up with his father and didn't have any uncles or anybody like that, he had no father figure, no male figures in his life to really give him any guidance. So now, when, you know, when you talk to somebody and they've had that street mentality for so long, you know, it takes a while to make them of that, you know, and let them know that this is not the way that things have to be, you know, or that this is the only way that things have to be, you know. And I'm not saying that you have to turn your back on that or turn your back on who you are or where you're from, but at the same time, though, you still have to be able to grow and mature and evolve beyond that. You know, I think that for him to have, you know, some people in his life that are actually able to give him some insight and some structure and let him know when he's wrong. You know, a lot of times people, especially when you stick your chest out and you're so big and bad, a lot of times people aren't even really willing to tell you that you're wrong. You know, so when he has people around that challenge his ideals and his way of thinking, it helps him grow and helps him become somebody who can, you know, potentially be strong enough to overcome this and break the cycle.
And breaking the cycle is ultimately the goal, I think, for our people in our community, man. And we talked about, like you said, the old heads that he encounters. And I'm not that old, but I'm older than some. And I take pride in being an old head for those people. You know what I mean? Because I've had people, family members, come up to me, friends, whomever, and look to me for advice, look to me as a role model, all that type of stuff. And I really take pride in that, and I take it seriously because I know what my old heads meant to me. And when I talk about my old heads, I'm talking about you. I'm talking about my father, of course. But then I'm also talking about, you know, my cousins, specifically my male Cleveland cousins, and my cousin Gavin on my mother's side. And, you know, I was the youngest of everything. I was the youngest on both sides of the family. So I have a certain appreciation for those positive male influences because, you know, it's not an accident that they've all been on the podcast, y'all. I mean, they've all been on the podcast pretty much. And these people are really important. They were instrumental in my personal development and growth, and they helped sculpt how I've decided to attack life. And I've seen what they've done. I've seen what they've done, and that's right, and I think it's dope. There's been some stuff that I didn't always agree with and some stuff that I may have done differently, but ultimately, they've always looked out for me and my best interests, and I've just been very blessed. You know what I'm saying? Blessed. I've been way up. I'm so blessed, you know? And I just think that I just wish that more people in our community had what I have. You know what I'm saying? Because I was one of the lucky ones. And if you are in a position to where you can be a positive influence to other people in the community, specifically the Black community and specifically to other young Black men, please take that responsibility seriously. I beg of you, because like you said, Kenny, we're never going to break that cycle unless we attempt to show the youngsters the way, man, because they're going to look up to us naturally. You know what I mean? That's just what they do. I mean, I looked up to all you guys from a very, very young age. And just because I just thought y'all was the coolest people I knew. Like, my brother and my cousins was just the dopest people I ever came across. You know what I'm saying? And then my cousins, it's funny because my cousins were all like at least 10 years older than me. And then I became an adult. And then they became even cooler to me because we were all adults now. You know what I'm saying? So we could do the same type of stuff. So it's just, it's a very serious responsibility that I just feel like, you know, is lost in our community, especially with the lack of fathers that are available. And a lot of them wind up being just prisoners of the system, of this judicial system, and they wind up locked up. And one last thing I want to touch on, too, was just the overall influence of hip-hop in the book, because this is a hip-hop podcast, after all, and there are elements of hip-hop sprinkled in. It's referenced specifically in certain spots. Talk a little bit about the impact of hip hop on this book, and as a product of hip hop culture, how did you even become an author? Because I think so many of us, you know, it's the classic cliche: either you slang crack rock, you got a wicked jump shot. That's the only way out. That's the only means, and that's how we view things at a young age, and sometimes even to adulthood, some people think that's still only the way out, and that's not the case. How did hip-hop impact you personally and then impact your writing in this book, and how did you even become an author to begin with?
Well, you know, it's funny you would ask me that question the way that you asked me it, because of the fact that it actually does tie into hip-hop. You know, as far as the actual, this book is in particular is concerned, I think that, you know, like I said, there is a lot of hip-hop references in the book. You know, I talk about Bone Thugs and Harmony in the book. You know, I remember when Bone Thugs and Harmony hit when I was in eighth grade, and that was like the biggest thing ever. I remember, because I was late.
It was over.
other people knew about Bone before me, but when I found out, it was like, wow. It was like, it was huge. And this is like when Thuggish Ruggish Bone hit. Not Crossroads Bone, but, you know, this is, I'm talking about, they didn't have money yet. That check didn't clear from Easy yet. So these guys were looking rough still, but they were doing their thing and they were putting it down. And, you know, they were putting on for Cleveland. And that's the thing is, if you look at Cleveland artists, man, and I'm talking about across the board, man, we're hungry, man, and we're hungry to put on for our city, man. We're tired of everybody else getting shine and everybody else getting looked and not having an opportunity for ourselves. That's why when you look at Bone Thugs and Harmony and how they put it down for Cleveland, and you look at Ray Cash and how he tried to put it down for Cleveland on his time, and how Machine Gun Kelly's trying to put it down for Cleveland now, and Styli calls his album Ohio. You know, this is not, you know, everybody that comes out for, you know, anybody who comes from Cleveland is swinging for the fences. Kid Cudi, everybody. And there's a reason for it. It's that we're tired, man. But, you know, that was the thing. It's just that for me, you know, that type of music, you know, and that passion was what kind of fueled the book in certain respects, you know. So I would definitely even credit all those guys, Ray Jr., all those guys as being a part of the inspiration of me writing this book, because I was listening to some of the stuff I was writing in Afghanistan. So I was so far removed from Cleveland at the time of writing it that, you know, I didn't even, you know, I had to have something to remind me of home. So to even just play that music and zone out kind of put me back in that mindset where I needed to be to get some of the writing accomplished. Like I said, beyond that, Freddie Gibbs, he was, his music's been a huge influence on the book, huge influence. You know, it's not quite Cleveland, but it's still the same Midwest state of mind.
And, Gary, Indiana, shout out.
Scary Gary, you know, it's you know, it's real out in Gary too, apparently. And, you know, like I said, it was just a lot of that was just very, you know, it was, helped inspire a lot of what I was writing in the book, you know, and, you know, so I think that overall, I think that was just kind of, there was always a good portion of the book that was inspired by that. But beyond that, you know, for me personally, I think that, you know, the first seeds were planted, I guess, as far as me being a writer, were just, you know, teachers in school telling me I was pretty good at writing and things like that. But then, you know, the one real thing that kind of took it off of me and said, you know what, I need to sit down and try to do this, was watching New York Undercover. And, you know, anybody who remembers that show, it was kind of like a early to mid-90s show, I believe, about, you know, cops in New York City. They're undercover cops, and it was like a very hip-hop edge to the show. They had a lot of musical guests. They were always in the lounge. Biggie was on the show. It was a very hip-hop-oriented show. Method Man was another featured guest on the show.
Ice-T. So
Ice-T was a regular character on the show. He was a great villain on the show. But watching that show, I said, you know what? I could do this. You know, I could write something where I could tell a story that, you know, might sound like something that, you know, people might want to hear, you know. And that was what, and I didn't not necessarily want to just write stuff like that per se, but it just kind of planted the seed. And the very first thing that I ever wrote, I was in, I think, the ninth grade, and I wrote an episode of New York Undercover. It was up to the specs of the show. So it was about, I think it was about 45 minutes worth of actual writing material that I compiled at the time, which is about 45 pages, because I guess the average, as they say, is one page equals a minute of camera time on air. So a page of dialogue anyway. So it was about the approximate length of what it needed to be to make it on the air. And I just figured I could just, you know, mail it to Fox and they would, you know, hire me as a high school kid. That's what I figured. That was honestly what I believed. And I remember sitting in my English class in high school, assuming and just like kind of looking out the window, waiting for Fox to just kind of drop out with a helicopter and have some people in it and say, hey, you need to come with us. You know, but obviously that didn't happen.
Well, I remember the end of the book. It was like JC was about to get shot or something, and like Eddie Torres throws his keys up in the air, and like the keys like reflected off the sunlight and got in his eyes. It was some real like Mission Impossible Tom Cruise type stuff, wasn't it?
You know what? Honestly, I don't remember all the details of it that far. I remember it had something to do about like an abortion clinic and something like that. But I do remember the keys going in the air. It's really heavy stuff to be writing as an eighth grader, ninth grader, but. Like I said, I always, you know, wanted to write stuff that was a little bit heavier. So, you know, that was just, I guess I have an old soul in that kind of context.
Well, I think that just goes to show that you were born to do this, and you are doing what you love to do because you've been doing it, like you said, since 8th or 9th grade or whatever, and you've been taking it seriously. And I clearly have been reading your work for quite a long time because I remember that. And I can say without hesitation that Natural Life is the best thing that I've read that you've ever written. Now, you've written a lot of stuff, so I haven't read everything. But everything that I've read, which includes all your books to this point, Natural Life is the best and most polished work I've seen to date. I'm very proud of you, and you were one of the influences why I started writing on the website. I mean, it's all related, man. I'm telling y'all, and it just kind of goes to show you what a couple kids from Cleveland can do.
One time for the city, my city. Justice League. Bitch, I'm from the land till I die, till I die, till I die. On the east side till I die, till I die. Till I die, bubbing that bone thugs till I die. Till I die, in the hood I'm good till I die. CLE till I die. Oh. Everywhere I go I'm putting on. Putting on, putting on. Everywhere I go I'm putting on. Putting on, putting on. Everywhere I go I'm putting on. Putting on, putting on. Everywhere I go I'm putting on. Putting on. Where you from? Straight out of the motherfucking crib, ho. On 128, me and Slim Doe. Damn, bro, we was smoking mid, bro. Baby mama, holla, how we supposed to live, though? Fuck that, beat the game up quick, though. Bam. Everybody in the team meeting. Green bills, green leaves, it's the green season. Catch me only up in sharp season. Whipping with the hot sauce like I'm street leaguing. A1 though, on the porch getting cut, though. I'm first block with a blunt roll. Me and Dubbo, my city, my city. Been turned up for the jump, though. From the land till I die.
Now, the NBA Finals, because we wouldn't be Sons of Cleveland, Ohio, if we didn't talk about the finals real quick. And we only have about maybe 10 or so more minutes, but what's about to happen in the finals, man? Now, I have a lot of thoughts, but I want to get your perspective first, and then I'll kind of unleash and let it go. So if you want to throw a prediction out there, if not, you don't have to, but what are you expecting, or what are you anticipating from this series? Because I think we got the matchup that most people wanted to see.
I would agree with that. I think that, by and large, I think this is the matchup that people wanted. This is the matchup I wanted, and this is not to my own horn, but this is the matchup that I predicted. I predicted this at the beginning of the playoffs, not at the beginning of the season. But, I just want to throw that little caveat out there.
I did the same. It's on the website.
As far as this series is concerned, I'm expecting, and I don't want to overhype it, but I'm really expecting this to be one of the better series that you've probably seen in the last 10 to 15 years. I think that these teams are kind of, I don't think that they're really matched well for each other. I think that it's going to be awkward for them to play against each other because I think their styles kind of conflict one another in certain respects. I think that they're both honestly equally talented. As far as Steph Curry is concerned, I think he's amazing. I think that, he's the player that I wish I could have been when I was out in the backyard or shooting hoops as a kid. You know, that was what I wanted to be. Literally, I wanted to play the way that he plays. But he just, obviously has the skill to pull it off. So, honestly, I don't see the Cavs stopping him, and I don't see Golden State stopping LeBron. So it's really going to really boil down to just whose team is a better team, I think, And even with that being said, I think they're very, very I won't say evenly matched up, but I'll say that they are overall, I would say that when you add all the intangibles, they're probably two very evenly matched teams.
Now,
quality concern.
Sure, sure. Now, we got two rookie coaches. We got two MVPs. We got Curry's the MVP. LeBron obviously is a four-time MVP. Most people, from what I've observed, and most people in the national media, seem to think Golden State is just going to steamroll the Cavaliers. Now, I kind of feel differently about that. And it's not that Golden State's not great, because I think they've been the best team in the NBA all season. And it's not an accident that they're here. But I just get the feeling that some, and this is just a gut feeling, that some of their guys might come up a little small in the moment. And when I think back, when I look at these two teams, I've said all year that as the Golden State Warriors are kind of mowed through everybody during the regular season, they reminded me a lot of the 09 Cavaliers. They had an MVP on the roster, first-time MVP. They lost two. Each team lost two games at home all season. Both were heavy favorites coming into the playoffs. Number one seeds that won well over 60 games. And the Cavaliers ran into Orlando, and due to some certain players shrinking in the spotlight and due to some horrible coaching, the Cavs fell short. I don't see Golden State suffering from horrible coaching. I can see a scenario where they maybe some of their guys come up a little small in some spots. I just wonder a little bit. I think Curry is going to be dynamic for the majority of the series. I can see a game where he throws a clunker in there, though. Like, I don't know that he's going to be great for seven games. Klay Thompson's been hit and miss all playoffs, and now he's got this concussion thing. And then the rest of their guys, none of their guys have ever been to this level. Even their veteran players have never been to this level. I think Barbosa's been to the conference finals once before. I don't think he's been in the finals. David Lee spent a bunch of years on the Knicks, so you know he didn't go nowhere. Same with Andrew Bogut with the Bucks. Same with Iguodala with the 76ers. None of these guys, even their vets, have gone this far before. Now, it's a fair point that the Cavaliers role players, some of those guys are crotchety old men at this point and can't jump over a bag of nickels. When I'm talking about Mike Miller, James Jones, Sean Marion, those guys, Kendrick Perkins, all four of those guys have played in the finals before. And all four of those guys have been on teams that won an NBA championship. I think that has to count for something. When everybody, I mean, experience isn't always the end-all, be-all, but when you have a situation where everybody on one team it has never been there before, ever, has never been on this level before, never been on this stage, and they're playing with expectation, that's a key thing. Like, it's one thing to be there and to have never been there before, but you're not expected to win. Now it's just a matter of overcoming the just happy to be there syndrome. Because if you actually come to play, you might not know what the magnitude of what you're doing, and you might actually pull it off. But if you're a team that's never been in this spotlight before, and you're expected to win, that's a lot of pressure for Harrison Barnes. That's a lot of pressure for Draymond Green. You know what I'm saying? I just wonder about this team that's had smooth sailing all year, no significant injuries all year, even in the Western Conference playoffs, which is supposed to be, you know, everybody talks about how difficult the West is all season. They didn't even play the two best teams in the West. The next two best teams, that was the Spurs and the Clippers, and they avoided both of them. Meanwhile, the Cavaliers played the two next best teams in the East. They played Atlanta and they played Chicago. Now, some people, you could argue, well, Washington's better than Atlanta. I think it's debatable, but given the fact that the Hawks actually beat the Wizards and the fact that the Hawks won 60 ball games this year, I'm going to go ahead and give them the nod over Washington. So the Hawks and Bulls were the perceived next two best teams in the East. The Cavs clobbered both of them without Kevin Love and with Kyrie Irving limping around. So I just kind of feel like the Cavs have much more of an advantage than most people realize. In addition to the fact that they have the best player on the court, and as long as LeBron is on the court, he is the best player. I don't give a damn how many threes Steph makes. And the fact that they have this experience thing on their side, and if Kyrie can come back healthy, I'm just saying, Kenny, I feel like if Kyrie can play Steph Curry to a draw, the Cavs still have LeBron, which is the big joker. I got Cavs in six. I got Cavs in six. So, I mean, I'm just saying, I think it's going to be a party down East 9th and Euclid and Prospect and all those streets in downtown Cleveland. I think this is the year the curse is lifted, unless the curse just kind of hovers over Quicken Loans Arena and zaps the energy away from the team. We've seen that too. Do you have any other thoughts on the finals and how it's going to shake out?
Let's say that, first of all, I want to send a personal thank you to Cavalier Iman Shumpert. He has reached out to Lil B, the bass god, and made sure that we will not be cursed. and that none of our players will be cursed during the finals, so we can have a level playing field here. And I just want to thank him for that, and I want to thank you, Base God, for that as well, because we don't want those problems in Cleveland.
Thank you, Base God.
Beyond that, I think that I would agree. I think that there definitely has to be something said for having experience. There definitely has to be something said for having the best player on earth on your side.
Right?
You know, it's hard for me to just write off a LeBron James team at this point of his career. You know, maybe when he's in a wheelchair or something, then I would still probably give it to the Cavs. But that's not the point. You know, he's still, you know, like I said, he's, as long as he's healthy, you know, he's still the greatest player on earth, and you can't just dismiss him or dismiss the team, you know, and act like they didn't earn their right to be here. Because they definitely did. They went through everybody that they were supposed to. And, in the, you know, and granted, you know, the East is still has perceived as being a weaker conference, and I agree with that, but, you know, they still went through everybody that they needed to. And again, if they went through the two hardest teams and Golden State didn't and struggled, you know, it just leaves room for questioning, you know. And if I had to make a choice, I would say Cavs in seven. It's hard for me to bet against the King, you know. At this point, you know, I got much love for Steph Curry. I got much love for Golden State, honestly. I really like their team a lot, and I wish them success in the future. But this year is our year, man. And I think the Cavs are bringing it home, and I will see you on West 9th, sir.
Hey, listen here, Steph. You come at the King, you best not miss. Word to Omar. I wish I would have had more time, man, because I kind of want to ask you real quick, and I'm just going to go ahead and do it anyway, but real quick, if you're Kevin Love, what are you thinking right now?
Well, I guess this podcast is going in overtime, folks. As far as Kevin Love, I would say, you know, I think that he definitely puts him in a precarious position for the team to succeed the way that they have without him. I think that the Cavaliers definitely want him back next season. And I think that ultimately, I think he wants to be back in Cleveland next season. You know, he hasn't actually verbally indicated to anyone that he had any displeasure at all in his time in Cleveland. It's just been this perceived notion that has been sitting out there in the media for whatever reason, but I got theories in that. But, you know, just this perceived notion that he is unhappy and wants to leave, but he's never stated anything of the sort. I think that if the Cavs are able to compensate him financially the way that he wants, he'll definitely want to stay and contribute to that back-to-back.
I mean, I would agree with that. I think that the Kevin Love exodus from Cleveland has been a little overstated because, to your point, he's never said anything of the sort. And I think it's an invention of the media because everybody leaves Cleveland, including LeBron James. And so because everybody leaves Cleveland, people are just expecting Kevin Love to want out, even though he wanted to come to Cleveland, and that's why he came in the first place. It's not his fault that he got hurt. And I think if he were out there playing with the team, I don't think people would be saying the same thing. I don't think people would be as convinced that he's bouncing if he was out there with the team, hitting threes, grabbing boards, doing an outlet pass thing, and going to the finals with this team. I don't know that people would be yelling as loudly from the rooftops that he's going to L.A. or Boston or wherever, or Houston. I just don't see it that way. Now, I could be wrong about that, and I could very well be wrong about the Cavs and Golden State, because Golden State is more than capable of beating the Cavs. I don't want to get it twisted. Like, you know, again, I think it's going to be six games, but a seven-game series would not surprise me in the slightest. I think Golden State is very capable if they play within themselves and hit shots. I mean, I think the Cavs kind of have a lot of different things to think about and worry about. I think if Golden State just hits shots, they'll probably win. And I know that's kind of an overly simplistic way of looking at it, but that's kind of how I see it. I just don't know that they'll be able to do it. The Cavs' defense has been much improved in the playoffs. And like I said, Steph Curry's going to be seeing a lot of Iman Shumpert. And it's just going to be an interesting... It's going to be an interesting series, man. I think they have the depth advantage in Golden State, too, so that can't be overlooked. I think they are a little bit deeper than the Cavs, but like I said, the Cavs, like the way Tristan's playing right now, the way JR and Shump are playing right now, even Dele is playing with confidence. If Kyrie comes back healthy, I don't see why they can't beat this Golden State team. Golden State is far from unbeatable, which a lot of people don't really seem to realize. But we'll have to leave it there, man. Thank you so much for joining us. this evening on the preseason podcast of the year. Natural Life is the book, y'all. Please pick it up yesterday. Pick it up. Where can we find this book again, Kenneth? Where are you located on social media? Tell us where to find you and the book.
You can pick up the book on my website, which is obeliskmediagroup.com. That's O-B-E-L-I-S-K, Media Group, all one word, .com. I'm sure that there'll be a link there on hiphopsportsreport.com as well for that. You can also reach me on Facebook, facebook.com/author.Kenneth Hicks. I'm on Twitter. You can get me on Twitter at Author K. Hicks on Twitter. Again, I'm, you know, we're just working here. You know, I'm still a regular contributor here on hiphopsportsreport.com. And like I said, I'm going to continue to hopefully get invited back for a couple more podcasts maybe. And I would like to, you know, continue writing articles here as well. And again, I just want to thank you for having the opportunity to speak today and this platform. And I, you know, I take nothing for granted, you know. And just because we're family doesn't mean that you have to do anything for me. So anytime anybody reaches out and gives me an opportunity to speak on my book and opportunity to, you know, maybe just get the word out about, you know, it's a great product here and a great opportunity to check out something new and check out something that's really, you know, bigger than just, you know, just telling a cool story. You know, and just having an opportunity to speak to people, so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No doubt, man. Natural Life, pick it up. The hottest book in 2015. I have links on the website, hiphopsportsreport.com. Check out the brand spanking new website, Hip Hop Sports Report. And we're on Twitter, of course, at HHS Report, and on Facebook. There's links on the new website as well for that. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe on the website for updates. And one other thing, y'all, Memorial Day just passed. Shout out to all of our veterans who held us down. Shout out to all the troops that are currently holding us down. And a special shout out to my uncle, Fred Bradley. I'm praying for you. I'm thinking about you. I love you. Same with Kenny. And we'll check y'all next time, man. Hopefully, the next time I talk to y'all, the Cleveland Cavaliers will be hoisting the Larry O'Brien Trophy. I had to think about that. The Larry O'Brien Trophy, y'all. We out of here. Natural Life. Kenneth Hicks. Appreciate you, man. Peace. Yes, flesh be running a whole check. Better check your Rolex. Yet time now for giving up respect to the messy team from senior league. We're scandalous niggas that dwell hell up on the far side and bail, leaving a trail of the bloody victims. The fifth dog mauling them all and never to catch me slipping and sipping and pipping and fighting. They give me nine instead of the tripping. We're flipping the scripts on over. See the bottom be never sober. Niggas told you trigger showed you East Nine Life. I've sold you. When I went red and wrong, try to run and get away, but it's just too late. Watch out, buckshots when I come buck. Better guard that fucking face. Dumping them slug on your fools. Rolling with me, true. Drinking brews. Don't start no shit. We come equipped, so niggas stay cool. 187. You think that you're going to heaven? With slugs all up in that chest. On the hell is where you be dwelling. Popping them, clipping them bodies, me dumping. Watching you fall to the pave with me 9 mil pumping. Putting them bodies all off in them graves. It's 1999.